for schools, educators, students and educational developments. Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, with live streaming on dublincityfm.ie. Inside Education is your weekly mix of news, interviews, stories and features from the world of education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'm glad you can tune this way. If you want to suggest a topic for the programme or to comment on an issue, you can email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation, all one word, at dublincityfm.ie. You can text the programme at 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665. You can listen to previous Inside Education programmes on our website. That is www.insideed.com. That's www.insideed.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at InsideEd. Coming up on today's programme.
All children are wired for language learning in the early years. So if we're exposed to just one language in the home and in the environment, that's what we'll pick up. But if we're exposed to two or more languages, then we'll pick them up. And we'll pick them up in the same way that native speakers of any language picks them up.
I'll be bringing you an interview with an internationally renowned expert on the topic of language learning, with an emphasis today on bilingualism and multilingualism. But as usual, we begin by taking a look back at the news stories about education from the last week. To do this, I'm joined, as always, by Barry Hennessy. What have you got for us this week, Barry?
Hello again, Sean. The junior ministers at the Department of Education and Science and the Department of Foreign Affairs, Sean Haughey and Peter Power, this week launched the Zambia-Ireland Teacher Education Partnership. This new initiative will see five teacher education colleges in Ireland working with similar institutions in Zambia on a comprehensive programme of mentoring and support in key areas of teacher training. Education professionals from Ireland remain very much in demand in many developing countries, and the current difficult jobs market has seen renewed interest in their skills. One of the organisations advertising for interested Irish teachers is VSO, which provides volunteers for two-year contract positions in over 40 countries. Earlier today, I spoke to VSO's Irish director, Malcolm Quigley, who was on a mobile phone at Dublin Airport. I first asked him to outline the reasons why Irish teachers might consider volunteering overseas.
Volunteering is an incredibly enriching experience, not just for the people that you'll be working with, but also for yourself. The kind of role that you would do fill as a VSO volunteer is a training role or an advisory role. So for teachers, for example, if we take Ethiopia, there, for example, you might be working in the Ministry of Education and you would be advising perhaps on the development of the national curriculum. You may also be in a teacher training college where you're actually training teacher trainers. For example, in Ethiopia in 2004, we helped establish the National Teacher Training Diploma, which through about 20 VSO volunteers, we were able to train in 1,100 teacher trainers who went on to train 11,000 teachers who went on to teach 800,000 children.
Malcolm, for somebody who's maybe been teaching for a couple of years or even longer and who's maybe become quite settled in the profession, the obvious question that arises here is what type of procedures or formalities are involved should they have an interest in volunteering, and how long will it be from the time they express the interest to when they might actually be on the ground?
If you apply to VSO, the places, the roles overseas, the volunteer places, are for 2 years. And when you apply, if you apply, you can apply via the website vso.ie. It will take about 6 months between application and actual placement overseas. There's a whole process in place where you have an assessment procedure which takes a day, and then there's training. So you'll have health and safety training, security briefings, and plus there's also then development training that you can follow. You know, what is development? What are we trying to achieve? What are the Millennium Development Goals? What are the particular goals in the country where you're going to go to? You know, those kind of things, you follow those courses. And at the same time, in parallel, your CV is with the partner overseas, because it's ultimately the partner organization that we work with who, you know, make the final decision on your CV. So that's happening in parallel, and so that takes time as well.
What about the financial aspects here? Because, I mean, clearly this is going to be one of the big issues for anybody who's in a job. What are the financial aspects, and what is provided in the destination country for you in terms of living arrangements?
Yeah, well, VSO doesn't believe you should be out of pocket for the experience, but at the same time, we don't believe you should profit from it because it is a volunteering role. So we do cover a lot of your costs, your flights going overseas, your medical expenses when you're overseas, your in-country costs such as accommodation, and you also receive an allowance, a living allowance, which is usually, it's a weighted average of the salary in that country, so it'll be about the average salary that is in that country, and then when you come back, we provide an allowance for to resettle back into Ireland as well.
And what type of living arrangements do people normally have when they're abroad?
The living arrangements we'd have overseas are quite basic, but they're not luxurious. You know, they're also not mud hut style, but you're somewhere in the middle there. It'd be the average. Style. Housing in Africa is quite good, and you may have problems with electricity, but you will have electricity and you will have running water.
Finally, Malcolm, you mentioned that many of the positions would be in an advisory role, such as within a Ministry of Education. And it begs the question here, is this all one-way traffic? I mean, are we still at the stage where, you know, we're going out to tell them how to run their countries? Or in fact, is there any sense in which the experience gained is actually a two-way one in terms of one's own practice upon returning to one's own country?
Well, the model that we've developed is very much, it's a very participative model in the sense that when we work with local partners on the ground, and in fact it's really the partner who decides, you know, do we want a VSO volunteer or not, and if we do, then what kind of person do we want? You're right in saying there is absolutely two-way learning. People take back home with them a greater sense of their own personal priorities, but also a greater sense of what our priorities in the world that we live in at the moment.
And that was Malcolm Quigley, the Irish Director of Voluntary Services Overseas, closing Barry Hennessy's news report for this week. You're tuned to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Inside Education with Sean Delaney. To get in touch with the programme, you can text 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665 for your comments or suggestions. The third annual conference of the English Language Support Teachers Association, or ELSTA, took place this weekend at the Merino Institute of Education here in Dublin. The theme of the conference was "The Journey is as Important as the Destination." One speaker at the conference was Professor Jim Cummins from the University of Toronto. Jim Cummins is originally from Ireland, but over the last 40 years he has established a reputation as a scholar and communicator on learning and teaching minority languages, bilingualism, multilingualism, and learning English as an additional language. He was in Dublin for just a brief visit to address the conference, but I caught up with him on behalf of listeners to Inside Education. I recorded an in-depth interview with him covering many issues related to language learning. I will bring you the interview in two parts. I begin this week with some of Jim Cummins' insights on learning multiple languages. I first asked Jim if it was possible to be fluent in more than one language.
Well, of course it is. There's all kinds of people in the world who are fluent in multiple languages, and it depends on the context that one grows up in. I remember, for example, years ago being in the Netherlands Antilles in Curaçao, and children on the street there were fluent in four languages. Their native language was Papiamento, which is a mixture of African languages and Portuguese. Their school language was Dutch. They learned English and Spanish to interact with tourists. And so these children were functioning in four languages, maybe not at a very high academic level, but if the context is right, children can pick up multiple languages relatively easily.
So I suppose what you're saying in one sense is that fluency is related to the context in which language is to be used.
Yeah, all children are wired for language learning in the early years. So if we're exposed to just one language in the home and in the environment, that's what we'll pick up. But if we're exposed to two or more languages, then we'll pick them up, and we'll pick them up in the same way that native speakers of any language picks them up. So, for example, one pattern that you get in a number of places is where parents speak different languages. One parent will speak one language to the child, the other parent will speak the other language, and children will go through a phase of initially using both languages simultaneously and mixing them together, and then they split up. They realize that with dad, I speak Irish, with mom, I speak Spanish, and then English is outside in the environment. And they slot them into the appropriate places in their brains.
And if children are working with more than one language from a very young age, does that affect their development in other areas of their learning?
There's quite a bit of research that has been done in the last 30 or so years that suggests that there are additional payoffs in terms of knowing multiple languages. There's certainly strong evidence that children who are exposed to multiple languages and develop bilingual or multilingual skills in the early years develop more awareness of language. They're more conscious of what you can do with language. There's also some evidence that switching across languages builds up their attention to pay attention to things. There is certainly strong evidence that children who are already bilingual have an easier time picking up additional languages. So in addition to just the obvious benefits in terms of one's life and what one can do and where one can go to knowing additional languages, there seems to be some additional icing on the cake, if you like, with respect to cognitive functioning and linguistic functioning.
And are there certain things that parents can do if they're bringing up their children with two languages? Are there things that they can do to make life easier or to make that experience more productive for their children?
It's really important that parents know what they're doing and have a, if you like, a plan of attack for developing children's languages. If it's haphazard and languages are being used in haphazard ways in the home, children may not develop as strong linguistically in either language as they might. So parents, first of all, need to know what they're aiming at. So are we aiming to have our children fluent in our two languages, and do we want our children to be literate in those languages? What are they going to use languages for, etc.? So having a clear set of goals is important. And then one needs to be aware that if there are two languages going on in the home, then children are probably being exposed to either one somewhat less than a child who is in a monolingual home. So parents need to be very conscious that they provide the interaction in the language that children will need. So that means finding time to interact with the child. For example, if a child might be watching television, maybe try to find television or video programs in the target language, if that's not the majority language of the society. Talk to children about what they're watching in the target language, in the home language that you're using. Make sure that you expose children to books and stories in that language. And so if we're doing that in two languages, then if we want those two languages to develop strongly, there's got to be the interaction, both conversational interaction and conversation over books and videos and other things that children may be engaged in. If we have grandparents who are accessible, either living with us or living close by, who speak the languages that we're trying to develop, they can be wonderful resources for helping to extend the linguistic environment. So parents need to know that languages don't develop in a vacuum. There's got to be interaction, and if they want to develop two or more languages in the home, then they've got to spend as much time interacting with their children in those languages as possible.
And I suppose that has got a little bit easier in recent times with technology, where, say, television programs are available in lots of languages and the internet as well.
Yeah, technology opens up all kinds of possibilities here. There are some negative aspects too. The fact that television is so pervasive and it's part of the community that children develop at a very early stage. They talk about their favourite programmes. The reality is that most programmes that children are likely to watch are going to be in the dominant language of the society. In the case of Ireland, that's English. And so if parents are trying to develop another language, let's say Spanish or Romanian, in the home is not a pure site for that language anymore, because English is infiltrating through television and through other media. And so children, parents need to perhaps limit the amount of television that children are watching so that there's more time for interaction in the language they're trying to develop. But at the same time, as you pointed out, there's the possibility of getting videos in the home language. There's a possibility of cable channels that one can pull into the house and watch. There's also interesting possibilities opening up with Skype, for example, and the possibility of interacting with, let's say, grandparents or relatives who are not physically present. They may be, if we're talking about a Romanian family, they may be in Romania, but they're hooked up to Skype. The children can see their grandparents, they can talk to them, and for young children, they seem to adapt to that very, very naturally. So one can use technology to extend the linguistic environment in ways that would not have been possible even 5 years ago.
Jim Commons went on to say that learners of English as an additional language benefit from developing good literacy skills at home in whatever language the parents speak.
The quality of communication in the home, the quality of exposure to literacy in the home is incredibly important in terms of providing a foundation for children in school. And it doesn't matter that that foundation may be in Spanish or Romanian or Yoruba or whatever the language might be. If children have got it in one language, they can transfer it to English. The sad part of it is when parents may pick up on either their own assumptions about the fact that they need to maximize exposure to English and minimize exposure to the first language, or have got wrong information from the school about this, and children end up without a foundation in any language. Sometimes in those cases, they lose their first language, and neither parents nor teachers often realize just how fragile those first languages are. Children can lose access to the first language within a year or two of being immersed in an English-speaking environment. And once it's gone, it's hard to get it back. And children, when they become teenagers, are often quite angry at their parents because they're angry that their parents didn't reinforce that language much more strongly than they did. And so there's a lot of misinformation out there. And so getting accurate information to parents, and I think it would be very appropriate for bodies such as school boards or ministries of education or groups like ELSTA to develop brochures with some of this basic information there, so that teachers could give this information to parents, so that there's accurate information about language use in the home and bilingualism. And what the research is saying about these issues is very clear. It's not complex. Bilingualism is an advantage to children cognitively and linguistically. It's a positive force in their development rather than a negative force. In order to develop bilingualism, we need to provide a strong foundation in the home for that first language, because otherwise it's going to be smothered by English. Parents need to have a policy in terms of understanding the need to communicate extensively in the language or languages they're using in the home, because otherwise they're not going to develop. And basically, schools and families need to work together to think about what kinds of language outcomes are we aiming for.
And if you learn two languages from a young age, does that make it easier subsequently in life to learn a third language?
There's a lot of research that points in that direction. It's like anything else. You know, if you've developed strategies for doing something, if you've become, let's say, a carpenter, and you've learned how to make chairs and tables, well, then moving on to making something else is not that that difficult. You've got a set of skills and experience that you can pull into it. And it seems to work the same way with language. Children who have been exposed to two languages, who have become fluent in two languages, seem to have a better awareness of how language works. When they're learning an additional language, it's almost like as if they know what to look for, and their brains are tuned to pulling out what they need in the language. So they've got better strategies for doing that.
Jim, how does the language we speak, or the languages we speak, affect how we think, or how does it influence how we think?
Well, the different languages slice up the world in different ways. Even though there's more of a globalized culture right now because of the internet and communications that are, to a certain extent, homogenizing linguistic differences and dialectal differences in many countries, there's still very specific kinds of impact that individual languages have on us. One common phenomenon that bilingual and multilingual people experience is that even though they may have learned additional languages after their childhood, if they've emigrated from their home country to another country, often they still carry out basic mathematical calculation in their original language, even though at this point, let's suppose the original language is Polish, and they've lived in an English-speaking country for, you know, most of their years. They haven't really developed Polish much beyond their childhood years. Many people will still count in Polish rather than in English, even though English is a stronger language. So there are some effects like that are fairly common. But the language reflects cultures, and people see the world in different ways. And so there are different kind of affordances, different possibilities, different things that stand out when we look at issues in one language as opposed to another. There's also the fact that if people maintain, or children maintain, their language, they've got much more possibilities for seeing things critically, seeing things from different points of view. Let's suppose we've got an Arabic speaker who could gain access to the Arabic language newspapers or to Arabic television stations during the Gulf War. That's going to give them a viewpoint that'll be very different from what they're getting from English language newspapers. And so having that access to other points of view, to other perspectives on the world, is something that literacy in additional languages gives. And clearly, that's part of our intelligence, and we're all, even a relatively small country like Ireland, is operating in the global environment and in all kinds of ways, from a business point of view, from a peacekeeping point of view. Seeing the multiple languages that have come into Ireland over the last 10, 15 years as being a resource for the country, an economic resource, as well as a cultural resource, is, I think, something that makes a huge amount of sense. And we need policies at the national level, but also policies at the educational level that will facilitate making use of those languages and encouraging their developments as resources for the whole country, not just resources for those individual children or families.
Jim, you're a sought-after speaker at conferences around the world. You are a prolific writer and researcher, and you teach and you work with teachers. I wonder, can you say a little bit about how you balance all those different aspects of your work?
Not very well. there's obviously a lot of demands and opportunities to work with teachers and to talk about these issues. And I think as our world has shrunk and as communication has increased and as we're in a situation where our social environment has become both more complex and more exciting in many countries because of the movement of populations, there are the issues that I've been working with have come more to the fore. Because if we take a country like Canada, which has had a major process of immigration throughout its history, but particularly in the last 20 years, you've got schools that are typically multilingual. The typical school is a multilingual school in the sense that there are children from all over the world in those schools. This creates issues of communication. It creates issues of what do we know about this reality? How can we create a vibrant learning environment in this context? And so these are issues that I think teachers are anxious to talk about, to find out more about what constitutes a really inspirational educational environment, given this complexity. And so we're out of our comfort zone in a number of situations. Teaching and education is not just transmitting a preset curriculum. We've got to tap into children's prior knowledge. We've got to tap into their experience. And if we've got a mini United Nations in a classroom, that's not a formulaic process. We've got to find ways of connecting with children's backgrounds. So there's the interest in work that I've done and other people have done comes from the fact that these are new realities, and there are there's an interest and a concern around the world to learn English as a global language. There's a concern also to maintain aspects of identity with minority languages that are endangered in many cases. There's a rapid loss of language, both at the individual and at the global level. And so there's a lot to talk about when it comes to these issues. And so, like many other people in this area, I balance as best as I can.
And that was Professor Jim Cummins from the University of Toronto. He addressed delegates yesterday at the third annual conference of ELSTA, the English Language Support Teachers Association. I want to thank Barbara O'Toole from the Merino Institute of Education for setting up the interview. On next week's programme, I'll speak to Jim Cummins about what teachers and schools can do to support learners of English as an additional language in their classrooms. Here is an excerpt of what he had to say on that topic.
The traditional way that we viewed linguistic diversity and children's knowledge of other languages has been as a problem. They have a problem because they don't know English. We need to teach them English. And so the first language has often been constructed as something problematic. In actual fact, when we look at what's happening in classrooms, or beginning to happen in classrooms around the world, when we look at children's languages and families' languages as a resource for learning, then all kinds of exciting things can happen in classrooms where the multiplicity of languages, the multiplicity of cultures is enriching for everybody. So creating a school climate that communicates this as soon as you walk in the door, and where children feel excited about being in a culturally diverse situation where they're learning from their peers and everybody has something to contribute, is a much more exciting place to teach in and a much more exciting place to learn in.
And you can hear the second part of the interview with Jim Cummins at the same time next week on Dublin City FM. That's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. If you have comments or suggestions for the programme, you can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That's insideeducation, all one word, at dublincityfm.ie. The text number for the programme is 086 8962 665. That's 086 8962 665. If you miss a programme, podcasts of previous programmes are available on the website, which is www.insideed.com. That's www.insideed.com. Thanks to Barry Hennessy for his news roundup. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. Up and Down, the Urban Music Programme, is next. Thank you.